Let's go back to July 27, 1981, location Hollywood, Florida. That is the day that Adam Walsh was abducted from the Sears store at the Hollywood Mall. It immediately made headline news. Search parties and posters pasted all over Hollywood, Florida, yet days have passed and no Adam. On August 10, 1981, a part of Adam was found in the canal. Let's go back to July 27, 1981, location Hollywood, Florida. That is the day that Adam Walsh was abducted from the Sears store at the Hollywood Mall. It immediately made headline news. Search parties and posters pasted all over Hollywood, Florida, yet days have passed and no Adam. On August 10, 1981, a part of Adam was found in the canal near Vero Beach, Florida, about 120 miles from where Adam was last seen at the Hollywood Mall. The rest of his body was never found. Now, history states that that vagrant serial killer, Otis Toole, confessed to the murder of Adam Walsh. Then he recanted, then he confessed, and then he recanted again. The uncertainty of did he really do it popped in the minds of many over the years, but in 2008, Otis Toole was declared guilty of the murder of Adam Walsh. Case closed? Or is it? Tonight on Mysteries, Mayhem, and Merlot, we will learn that there are key eyewitnesses that day at the Hollywood Mall, and all state that Otis Toole wasn't the serial killer that took Adam that day, but another prolific serial killer did. Author and witness Willis Morgan will take us down this twisted road with his book, Frustrated Witness. It's time to start the show. Let's hit it. Willis Morgan was born in Port Jefferson, Long Island. He graduated from Bellport High School and went to Suffolk County Community College before joining the United States Air Force as a security police officer. In 1972, Willis moved to Miami and started working for the Miami Herald. And in 1977, he became the supervisor in charge of the training program for the press room. In 1981, Willis became involved in the Adam Walsh case after he had an encounter with one of America's most notorious serial killers in a Radio Shack located in the Hollywood Mall in Hollywood, Florida. The day was July 27, 1981. That was the same day that Adam Walsh was abducted. Now, after being brushed off by the Hollywood Police Department when he tried to tell them what happened, Willis spent well over four decades trying to find justice for Adam. After the Hollywood Police Department closed the case on December 16, 2008, pinning Adam's murder on a serial confessor, Otis Toole, Willis started tracking down other witnesses to find out where the police went wrong. It was also about that time that Willis started writing his book, Frustrated Witness. Willis wants the world to know that it was not Otis Toole who murdered Adam. Welcome to the show, Willis. It's a pleasure having you on. So welcome to the show, Willis. Thanks for being on Mysteries, Mayhem, and Merlot. Now, let's go back to when your life started in Florida.
In 1972, when I moved to Florida and I started working for the Miami Herald, we will work 4-day work week, 10-hour shifts, 4 days a week, 40 hours a week. So anyway, in 1981, on July 27th, was my middle day off on a Monday. My days off were Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. And I decided to go to the Hollywood Mall to have lunch at the German Deli located inside the mall. And on my way to the German Deli, I decided to stop off in Radio Shack and it was in Radio Shack when this young man approached me and tried to start a conversation with me that turned out to be extremely bizarre.
Really?
I never responded to him. So he eventually just got so angry, he turned around and stomped out of the Radio Shack. But that encounter was so bizarre that I knew somebody was going to be in trouble.
What was his behavior like? Like, was he just awkward, or was he just like trying to get information? Like, what was his reason to go up to you to want to talk to you?
Right. Well, it wasn't just his behavior. It was his whole persona. It was he was disheveled and had this dead old look in his eyes. And at the same time, he was smiling while he was trying to ask me questions. He was asking me, you know, nice day, isn't it? You know, things like that. And so I didn't respond. My thinking was, if you respond, it just initiates conversation. So he got really angry that I wouldn't respond, and he eventually just turned around and stomped out of the Radio Shack.
Strange.
But because of that encounter that I had with this, because of this encounter, I knew somebody was going to be in trouble. But my thinking was, he would approach somebody my age, and I was about 34 at that time, and he was about 21, this guy, that I would find out 10 years later, his age. And so I was watching him, but I was thinking that he was going to go up to someone, there would be words exchanged like he tried to do with me, maybe a shoving match or a fight, and somebody might need a witness or some help. But never in 1981 did I think a six-year-old boy would be in trouble. So I watched him, actually watched him walk into the Sears toy department.
Wow. But
I turned around and left, because my thinking was that he's probably just playing the video games himself when I didn't see him come back out of the toy department. That was all I was thinking. And I went home, and it was that very same evening that I heard about this abduction. And they mentioned on the radio, on TV, I should say, it was on TV, on the local news station, they mentioned the Hollywood Mall, the toys department, and the time of day, which was the exact time that I saw this guy walking into that toy department. And I knew it had to be that guy. I just didn't have a clue who he was. He never did tell me his name.
It's been a frustrating 5 days since six-year-old Adam Walsh was last seen. His disappearance has prompted community-wide concern in South Broward. Late this afternoon, volunteers met with Adam's parents to continue their search. Close to tears, John Walsh stood on a car, asking people not to give up hope.
We've searched and searched for Adam, and we haven't found a body. So everybody thinks he's alive. We do, too. And we feel that since you people have searched so hard, the best thing we can do now is get these flyers in everybody's hands, because the police are so frustrated. Nobody's really come forth, and the clues that we have, really, we haven't come up with anything substantial.
Adam's mother, Reve Walsh, says the new strategy in the search is to expand it beyond Hollywood.
The most important thing now is to get the flyer, that the people can do, is to get the flyers out of the area. Now, they have to use their own detective, you know, their own senses to think of their own ideas. I don't want them to wait for someone to tell them what to do.
The reward for information leading to the whereabouts of Adam Walsh is now $50,000. Spiro Canton, Newswatch 10 in South Broward.
So I went to the Hollywood Police Department. They did tell him my story, yes. And they just brushed me off. I walked out of there feeling like a jerk for wasting my time even going there. That's how bad they treated me when I went there. I say all they wanted was a tag number and receipt to prove I was there. And in the end, I didn't have either one of those because I didn't buy anything. And the encounter happened in the interior of the mall, not outside in the parking lot, like other witnesses were. So I didn't have that. They told me at the time, okay, we have your statement. If we need you, we'll contact you. And they've never contacted me. And days later, composites started coming out that I knew whoever gave those composites at the time. I didn't know who the witnesses were at that time that gave those composites, but I knew whoever gave those composites saw the same person I saw, because they were as good as you can get. In fact, I didn't think I could do any better. So that's why I never bothered to call the police back and tell them, yes, that's the guy, because I'm thinking, well, you know, I have nothing to offer. They have their composite now. What else can I do? And so I let it go.
Yeah, because basically the information that you would have given them is basically what the composite was. What does this guy look like? What if, did anybody see him driving in a vehicle? Things like that. So you pretty much say, okay, they got the information that I would have given them. And of course, when you see that on TV at that night and you're sitting on your couch, your gut probably just dropped to the floor because you just had that gut feeling. So once you went to the police and they kind of shooed you away, what happened after that? What did you try? And I mean, did you still have that knowing thing in the back of your head that you felt like you had to do something more than what you had already done? Or before they found Adam, like, what was that week prior to that?
I did try to do something. What I did was they were asking for volunteers to join search parties. And so I joined because I felt so bad about what happened, you know, that I was there and maybe I could have done something, and I turned around and left. And so I joined the search parties, and we were searching backyards and, garbage cans. They explained to us what to look for, you know, Adam's captain's hat and the shirt he was wearing and the flip-flops and all that. And we were looking everywhere. But, of course, we've never found anything. After that, I was reading stories because I worked for a newspaper, so I was keeping up with the story, and I was reading about them going after John Walsh's house guest because they considered him to be a prime suspect because he had, according to their theories and their beliefs, he had the motive and everything else to be a suspect. So my thinking was I knew it couldn't be this guy. I never even knew what he looked like. I never saw him. But I knew it wasn't him because they were saying that Adam was targeted in revenge by this guy, James Campbell. And I knew that wasn't the case because he came up to me first and he meandered through the mall before he ended up in the toy department. So Adam wasn't targeted. And like I said, I knew it wasn't this guy. Had they charged this guy, James Campbell, I would have gone to his aid, but they never charged him. Eventually they dropped the case against James Campbell.
Now, Adam was found August 10th, 1981.
The case lingered for a while, for about 2 years. And then in 1983, I went to work on the night shift. And the press room secretary, Monica, she came up to me with a newspaper. And she said, Willis, is this the guy you saw in the mall? And I looked at it and I said, no. And she said, are you sure? Because he said he did it. And I looked at it again and I said, no, that's not him. Later, I read the article. And it was about this guy named Otis Elwood Toole, who was confessing to Adam's demise.
December 16, 1983, you know, they arrested him on unrelated charges.
And I knew it wasn't this guy. I was thinking about going back to the police to tell them, no, this guy wasn't the guy, but I didn't. My thinking is they would figure it out, you know, in short order, because this guy didn't have a blue van. There were witnesses that were saying there was a blue van involved. Some of the witnesses that were outside in the parking lot that also witnessed this incident. And so I'm thinking that they would figure this out. And, you know, eventually they did figure it out. After about 4 months, they dropped him as a viable suspect. And he was completely eliminated as a suspect by all the detectives involved in the case that were investigating it at that time in 1983. So Otis Toole was completely dismissed, but it was decades later when Otis Toole again reemerged because one of the detectives wanted to close the case. And so he pinned this murder on Otis Toole, who was dismissed.
Now, what was your kind of inclination? You said that people saw a blue van. How many other witnesses saw this strange gentleman meandering through the Sears department store? Were there other witnesses, anything that went to the police, or were you the only one that went to the police with this particular suspect other than the person that identified or did the composite sketch?
Well, some witnesses went to the police. Some tried to call them. They couldn't get through. Some were told to come back in 2 weeks. The investigator that's on that case is on vacation. They were given all kinds of excuses and reasons.
Which is very detrimental to the case because when you take an eyewitness's statement, a lot of times it's hard to recall. And when you have to wait 2 weeks to give a statement on something that you saw briefly, you're not going to get very accurate information.
The Hollywood Police Department refused to release the case files, okay? And in 1995, there was a lawsuit against them, and it was by a reporter named Jay Greenland. And he eventually won that lawsuit, and they were forced to release the case files. That was in 1996,
Okay.
they had released them. I never did get a copy of those files, and years later, when after they closed the case, they were forced to release the files again, because once the case is closed, see, their excuse for not releasing them was that this is an open case, it's still being investigated. And once they closed the case, they couldn't use that excuse any longer, so they had to release the case files. And I got a
Okay.
copy of them, and that's when I started looking through them. And that's when I saw that one of the composites in there that I was thinking was from the Hollywood Mall. And I realized when I was reading the case files that one of those composites weren't from the Hollywood Mall. It was from another mall where there was an exact same incident with a white male, 6 feet tall, with a blue van. And everything in that incident mirrors Hollywood Mall incident, except for one thing. Reveille Walsh took Adam to the Hollywood Mall to shop for a lamp and left him in the toy department. Ginger Keaton went to the Twin City Mall to shop for a dress while she left her son in the toy department. This disheveled man came up and tried to snatch and grab her son, Terry Keaton, who was at the time 10 years old. So he managed to get away. Adam was only six, he couldn't get away. He ran to the clothing department and begged for help. There was a woman with her son, a 10-year-old son there, and he begged her for help. And his mother went corridor of the mall. They saw this guy that they had that tried to grab Terry, and Terry pointed it out to his mom and said, "Mom, that's the man, that's the man." And she says, these are her words, that he gave her this stare that was so made her so scared that she just wanted to get out of there. She grabbed her son and got out of there and went home. And she said on her way out, she saw a blue van parked there, and she didn't at the time thought it could possibly be connected, but didn't really think too much of it. And anyways, this was on July 13th, 2 weeks on a Monday, two Mondays before Adam was abducted. So after Adam was abducted, witnesses from that incident, July 13th, and the police chief, John Atwater, all called the Hollywood Police Department to tell them they think that incident is related to the Adam Walsh case because everything is matching, including the composites.
Out of an attempted abduction at this Sears store in North Palm Beach has police interested. The woman told detectives she saw a man chase after a young boy here a month ago. Two Hollywood detectives went to North Palm Beach today to question four Sears employees. The detectives said it was possible the woman saw a security guard chase a young shoplifting suspect, but they emphasized they still have to question several more people, including the 10-year-old boy who was the target of the supposed abduction attempt. While those detectives were in Palm Beach County, other investigators here questioned a 10-year-old boy who was in the Hollywood Sears store July 27th, the day Adam Walsh disappeared. With his mother's permission, the boy was placed under hypnosis for nearly an hour and a half and gave police a description of a man and vehicle outside Sears that day. The boy described a late model navy blue Ford van with a black front bumper, a chrome ladder on the left rear, shiny mag wheels, tinted windows, and Florida license plates. And the same boy described a man getting into the van as 5 feet 10 to 6 feet tall, medium to heavy build, with dark hair and a mustache, a description not unlike the one furnished by a Palm Beach County woman yesterday. Police are taking more than 200 calls an hour on the Walsh case. One detective describes the barrage of phone calls here as a madhouse. At a Hollywood funeral home, people stopped by all afternoon to express sympathy to Adam Walsh's family. Many of those who come here are strangers, people who never knew young Adam Walsh. And here, too, there are police detectives present to look for anything that might further their investigation as they try to find Adam Walsh's killer. Steve Bosquet, Newswatch 10.
Witnesses that gave composites from the Hollywood Wall, for example, one young boy that was, I believe, 9 or 10 years old, his name was Timothy Pottenberg. He's the first witness that initiated the first bolo that was came out. And okay. He's the one that described the blue van, the 6-foot-tall white male, and made the first composite from the Hollywood Mall. And they accused him of seeing the Twin City Mall incident on TV and making his composite look like that composite because they were so similar. And so they dismissed mm-hmm. him. They dismissed him, thinking that he just saw the other incident on TV and he's getting mixed up.
Wow.
And how in the world can a police department gather information from eyewitnesses, gave the police department their accounts of what happened and what they saw,
right,
and have another police department come in and say, hey, we had the same incident 2 weeks prior, and I think they're related. How can they completely dismiss that and say the cases are unrelated?
Right.
That is shoddy police work. No wonder Revay and John Walsh were so frustrated with the Hollywood Police Department. They should have been following up on every lead that they got to find Adam.
Right. Let me explain to you. Not only was John Atwater, the police chief from Riviera Beach, where the Twin City Mall was located, not only did he call, but there were other police chiefs calling him as well. There was an incident in South Beach, and they not only called the Hollywood Police Department, but wrote up a report for that incident and had it, the hard copy of the report, hand-delivered to the Hollywood Police Department. And they called the Hollywood Police Department and said that incident is related. There was another one in Plantation. There was another one in Deerfield Beach.
Really?
So there were other incidents, and all these police chiefs were calling the Hollywood Police Department and witnesses from those locations, and they were dismissing not only the witnesses, but the police chiefs from other locations as well. Because, like I said, at that time, the lead detective, Jack Hoffman, was so convinced that he had his suspect, James Campbell. Uh-huh. He may have had good reason to consider James Campbell as a suspect. In fact, the Twin City Mall incident that I told you about, one of the reasons he dismissed that incident is because the composites didn't match James Campbell, but they did match the Hollywood Mall.
Wow.
So instead of dismissing James Campbell, right, instead of dismissing James Campbell, he dismisses all the witnesses from the Hollywood Mall, the Twin City Mall, and all these police chiefs from other cities that were calling him. He dismissed everybody. Because he had blinders on, and he was zeroed in on James Campbell.
My favorite spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity that you get. That, wow, how have I been living like this feeling? It's kind of like when you find out that you've been paying a fortune for wireless when Mint Mobile has phone plans for just $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. Wow, how have I been affording this? It's time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. The quality that I've received from Mint Mobile is second to none, and I've tried them all. And this is an amazing company to work with that actually cares about their clients and the prices that they charge. So if you're on that fence wondering, should I make the shift? You're going to get great coverage, you're going to get great customer service, and all of the bells and whistles you expect from the bigger brand names. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans and their jaw-dropping monthly bills and unexpected overages. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans starting at just $15 a month. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/P60. That's mintmobile.com/P60. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/P60. SP60. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to just $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Yeah, it's so disappointing. I've seen it before with other police departments and other high-profile cases. Usually it's because there's power to gain. Whether the police chief wants to run for some type of political office or run for commissioner, you know, they want to get that notch in their belt, I guess, just to say, you know, hey, look what I did. It's more me now, and gives them something to talk about while they're glad hand and shaking hands, kissing babies at their political rally. And to sit there and have blinders on to a guy that doesn't even make sense at all, in my opinion. And then to move over to a guy who's like this homeless drifter who's a psychopath just terrorizing every town he goes through. Now, don't get me wrong. Otis Toole was not a great guy. I mean, he murdered people. He was a known arsonist. He admitted to cannibalism. But it's like, could you really believe what Otis Toole would say? Because he even confessed to crimes he did not even commit. So to say that was his confession of Adam Walsh, was that fiction or fact? I mean, I'm glad he got off the streets.
Right. Well, you notice Otis Toole looks nothing like any of the composites, you know?
I know.
First of all, the suspect, according to all the witnesses, including myself, said he was about 20 years old. I think one witness, the youngest statement has him at 19, and the oldest has him at 24, 25. Because one of the questions the police always ask witnesses, you know, how tall was he? How old was he? So the age range from witness statements was 19 to 24 or 5. And Otis Toole was 34 at the time and had a receding hairline. And none of the composites have a suspect with a receding hairline either. And then eventually, like I said, in 2008, when I finally got a hold of the case files and started tracking witnesses down, and I showed them the composites, and they remembered making those composites. And then I showed them pictures of Otis Toole, and they said, no, that's not the guy we saw. And I showed them composites and photos of Jeffrey Dahmer, and they said, yes, that's the guy we were trying to describe. That's him.
Which that is going to bring us to July 22nd, 1991, which was just 5 days shy of the 10-year anniversary of Adam Walsh's abduction.
Some story leads off our newscast.
Milwaukee police found body parts in a Northside apartment, and now they wonder if they've uncovered some kind of death factory. This was the scene earlier this morning. Police hired a private contractor to haul a refrigerator and a tank of acid out of the apartment in the 900 block of North 25th Street. Because of the acid, some neighbors were evacuated briefly. Police found parts of bodies, leading them to believe the man they arrested is a mass murderer.
From our investigation, we feel that this individual strongly is involved in other homicides. We have taken evidence out of the building by the medical examiner to be examined.
What brought the police here in the first place?
The officers were stopped by an individual who claimed he was in the apartment and became engaged in a dispute with the owner of the apartment and left the apartment and called the officers.
A 31-year-old man was arrested at that apartment. The Milwaukee County Medical Examiner will release more details on this case. This
day you go to work, start seeing the newspapers coming out of the press, and you see this mugshot, and that's the very same face that you saw 10 years prior at the Hollywood Mall. What the hell went through your head? I mean, I think I would have just entered a Twilight episode if that would have happened to me.
What we do is once the presses start running, we get copies of papers from each press. So we had 8 presses running, okay, on this edition, and we lay them out on a long table to make sure everybody has all the same pages, you know, just as a double check to make sure nobody's running a wrong page in the paper. So we were going through one page at a time, calling off the page numbers and like that, and then we came to a page, we believe it was an A section, like 8A. And I just froze. I saw this mugshot and a little story. It wasn't much of a story, but it was about something that happened up in Milwaukee. And I looked at that mugshot and I said, this is him. This is the guy I saw in the mall. And then I heard voices around me saying, Willis, what are you talking about? And I heard somebody else say, calm down.
How can you calm down? I mean, you've had this guy's face rattling around in your brain for 10 years. Nobody will listen to you, even though you know your hunch is probably 98% right. You can finally put flesh to the paper and see the face that you saw July 27th, 1981, and taking this guy's picture, who is now in the public eye, and bringing that to the police department to say, hey, can we take a look at this to see if this corresponds with any of the witness statements to say that this guy's a better fit than Otis Toole?
So I did go back to the police department.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went back to them, again, they blew me off. They told me, well, the detective is on vacation. He'll give you a call back when he gets in. And it took like 4 months later, he finally called me, asked me to come in. What happened was, in the meantime, during those 4 months when he called me, I went to the storage room, the Miami Herald Library, we called it. It was really a storage room, because back in the 80s, they didn't have computers where they would save digital copies of things. So we saved hard copies of every paper in a large storage room. So I went to them and I asked them to find a composite that was in the paper back in 1981. And they gave me a composite. And I had the mugshot from the paper. And I took that back when Jack Hoffman finally called me in after 4 months to come in for an interview. I took that composite with me from the library. And then I took the mugshot from the newspaper. I took the newspaper with me. I went back to see him. And I showed it to him. I said, look, this is the guy I saw in the mall. And he looked and his jaw dropped. And
really?
I was thinking he knew something, but he wasn't telling me. His response was, I don't see it. They look nothing alike. And I'm thinking, really? What do you mean? Nothing. Nobody else I showed it to said that. But I didn't realize at the time. This guy had already gone into full cover-up mode the day Jeffrey Dahmer was captured, because he did not want to make the connection whatsoever to Jeffrey Dahmer. He did everything he could not to make that connection, and he completely dismissed everything. In fact, it took a year and a half for John Walsh to finally convince him to go up and interview Dahmer. He did not want to go up. He made one excuse after another not to interview Jeffrey Dahmer. Finally, John Walsh got fed up, because Jeffrey Dahmer's own father, Lionel Dahmer, called John Walsh at America's Most Wanted and told him he thinks his son murdered Adam. In his own book, Lionel Dahmer wrote a book called Father's Story. It's about the life raising Jeffrey Dahmer, and he talks about how he called America's Most Wanted and told him that his son murdered Adam.
Once you were able to get the case files, and then you had access to the witnesses that were there, and the one that, you know, Terry almost got abducted by this gentleman, did they confirm that Dahmer, that was the man in the composite?
Oh, yes, of course. In fact, before I ever even contacted Terry, okay, and showed him composites of Dahmer, and his story is that back in 1991, remember, I didn't get the files. I didn't contact Terry till it was like 2009, after the case files were released. So, when Dahmer was captured, he was in his living room with his mother. They were watching TV, and there was a story about Dahmer that came on, and he jumped up out of his seat, according to his mother and himself. He jumped up out of his seat and said, Ma, look, that's the guy. That's the guy. And his mother also saw the guy, because remember, they were out in the corridor when he pointed him out to his mother. And his mother said he gave her this look that scared her to death. So she confirmed. She said, yes, that's him. So this is before I even contacted him, that he said it was Jeffrey Dahmer, as well as numerous other witnesses. Okay. Mm-hmm. John Walsh wrote his book, Tears of Rage. I don't know if he ever had a chance to read it, but the rage was over the way the Hollywood Police Department was conducting his son's investigation. He has a lot of nasty things to say about the Hollywood Police Department. Okay, when he wrote that book, he called them the biggest bunch of stumbling, bumbling idiots since the Keystone Cops. When they pinned it on Otis Toole, all of a sudden, in 2008, the same police department are his best friends and colleagues. It's like the Stockholm Syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they... He was victimized twice, you know?
Yeah.
Once when Adam was murdered, and once by the Hollywood Police Department for giving him a false closure. Back in 1981, when they were investigating, these detectives were stumbling all over the place. They had no clue what they were doing. They never had a case this big, so they had no clue how to handle it. What they did, they wanted to do polygraphs on the Walshes, so they hired this detective out of South Beach. He was a homicide detective for Miami Beach Police Department. But on the side, he had his own business also called the Southern Institute of Polygraph. And the Hollywood Police Department hired his company to do the polygraphs. So this detective, his name is Detective Joe Matthews. He's the one that did the polygraphs. And he exonerated the Walshes and James Campbell. So when John Walsh became the host for America's Most Wanted, this detective called John and befriended him. And John Walsh remembered that he was the one that exonerated James Campbell and himself. So John went and hired him as the senior lead investigator on America's Most Wanted. So now John had one of these bumbling, stumbling, idiot detectives, those are his words, on his show as the senior lead investigator for 12 years, feeding him this false artist-tool narrative. So he's the one that convinced, I believe, in my opinion, he's the one that convinced John Walsh that it was artist-tool. Mm-hmm. Now, he wrote a manuscript called The Matthews Report. It's a 400-page manuscript pinning the murder on Artis Toole. And it was this manuscript that he gave to the Hollywood Police Department that they used to close the case. After the case was closed, he took that manuscript and gave it to his co-author, took that manuscript and formulated it into a book called Bringing Adam Home. Now, nobody can get a copy of that manuscript, but what we do have is a copy of Joe Matthews' book, Bringing Adam Home. In that book, he uses witnesses to pin the murder on Artis Toole, okay? And the witnesses that are all in my book, a dozen of them at least, none of them are mentioned in his book, Bringing Adam Home. The only witnesses he uses are witnesses like Artis Toole's cellmates that all say things like, yeah, everybody knows he did it. You know, it's all over the news. Mm-hmm. Everybody in prison knows he did it. Those are not witnesses. The witnesses that I use are percipient witnesses that were actually at the Hollywood Ball when Adam was abducted. So here's some of the witnesses that Joe used, okay? There's this narrative out there that Artis Toole gave this deathbed confession, right? Mm-hmm. I'm sure you heard about it too. Well, that never happened. There never was a deathbed confession from Artis Toole. But yet, if you look on the internet everywhere, you will hear all kinds of stories about this deathbed confession. This was made up by this detective. It's in his book. Mm-hmm. He uses Artis Toole's niece to claim that Artis Toole gave a deathbed confession. His niece is Sarah Patterson. Okay. Now, he claims Sarah Patterson called him and said her uncle gave a deathbed confession to her. But when I was looking for the case files, I saw Sarah Patterson's statement under oath that she gave to the state attorney's office. Okay?
Okay.
Her statement is that, first of all, she didn't, last time she saw her uncle, Artis Toole, was 9 months before he passed away. So that right there is not a deathbed confession.
Right.
And then And then even then, she says, I can't say that he did it. I wasn't there. I don't know. And she says, by the way, when you see John Walsh, tell him that guy is a jerk. And Phil Mundy, who was doing the interview, said, you're talking about Joe Matthews? And she said, yeah, Joe Matthews. He's a jerk because he takes everything out of context. Another one that he claims overheard Artis Toole giving that deathbed confession is, his name is Barry Gramilli. Okay. Now, he claimed Barry Grimilli was the one that was in charge of the infirmary where Otis II passed away.
Okay.
So he claimed Barry Grimilli, in his book, Bringing Adam Home, called him and said that he overheard that the deathbed confession. Well, you know, Sarah Patterson has passed away. So is Barry Grimilli. So there's no way to hear their story now. But what there is what they left behind. Barry Grimilli also gave an interview with the state attorney's office. And in his interview, under oath again, this is what he said. Okay, I'm paraphrasing. I don't have it in front of me.
Okay.
But he was telling, again, with Phil Mundy, who was the investigator for the 17th Court in Broward County. He said, Barry Grimilli said that, I was watching TV one night, and I heard John Walsh come on and say something about a deathbed confession. And that's just not so. Otis II never opened up about anything. So how does Joe Matthews say that he called Joe on America's Most Wanted? Because remember, Joe Matthews was now in charge of the he was a senior lead investigator on America's Most Wanted. So he's saying that Barry Grimilli called him and told him that Otis II, why would he tell him that he overheard the confession and then under oath now say something completely different, you know? So this is
right.
Joe Matthews does. He uses witnesses that have passed away and says they said things they didn't say.
Yeah, because they're not alive to say otherwise.
Nobody's going to read the case files to figure out the truth. What the narrative is that they're using, okay, is that the security guard was called. She put four boys out into the parking lot, Adam being one of them, and he was wandering around out in the parking lot, and the Otis II offered him candy, and the boy, Adam, willingly got into his car. That's the narrative that they used to close the case, which goes flies in the face of all the witnesses that saw Adam being dragged out of the store. Okay? Phil Mundy saw Adam, when he went to Sears, okay, he lost his parking space because there was this blue van parked in the fire lane and it was blocking traffic and cars had to funnel around it into a single lane, north and southbound. And because of that, somebody zipped into the space he wanted and he had to get a further space out. And when he went into the Sears, he had to walk around that blue van that caused him to lose his space. So he was a little upset. As he goes into Sears, he saw this man dragging this boy, and the boy was screaming, "You're not my daddy. I don't want to go. I don't want to go. You're not my daddy." And he turns around backwards, starts watching this because his son was about the same age, and he knows he wouldn't carry his son like that. And he tried to remember the incident and remember the boy. He could remember everything, so he's concentrated on Adam. Okay? Now, when he called the police, he described Adam to a T. You know, he mentioned, and the thing is, when you read his statement, they dismissed him before he even gave his statement. What happened was he went to the Hollywood Police Department first, and he talked to Detective Mark Smith, who completely dismissed him, because this was in 1991, after Dahmer was captured. And I believe they went into full cover-up mode when I went back to them, and I showed him that composite, and Jack Hoffman realized that was from the Twin City Mall. He didn't tell me that composite was the wrong composite. I didn't know about it until 2008 when I got the case filed. But he knew because he's the one that investigated the Twin City Mall. And he completely dismissed it. Phil went to the police, and Mark Smith dismissed him. So he went over Mark Smith's head to his supervisor, who was a Lieutenant Dunbar. Was his name. And he also dismissed Phil, even though Phil described the incident to a T, but this was years later. He couldn't remember the exact day that it was by this time. So he went to the state attorney's office to tell them the story. And it was Phil Mundy that interviewed him and dismissed him before the interview even took place. In fact, he wrote a letter, Phil Mundy, attached to the interview, saying the only reason he's given Phil this interview, because Phil went to Mark Smith, was dismissed, went over Mark Smith's head to Dunbar, and was also dismissed, and he worked his way over to my office, and he's very sarcastic and demanding this interview, so I'm going to give it to him just to satisfy him. During that interview, Phil mentions about Adam's clothing, everything to a T, describes Adam. And then he mentions the blue van. And Phil goes, oh, there was a blue van? And yet still in the end, he dismisses this guy because he couldn't remember what day it was exactly, you know, July 27th after 10 years. But even though he gets everything else right, they still dismissed him. And this is what they did with one witness after another. They found one way to dismiss every witness. Another one I'll give you real quick. Vernon Jones was a 9-year-old black boy. Mm-hmm. He was visiting his grandfather, Otis Toole. Otis is with two T's. Otis is one T. O-T-I-S and Otis is O-T-T-I-S. But anyway, Otis Toole went to the Hollywood Bowl with his son, with his nephew, Vernon. Mm-hmm. He wanted to go buy some tools in the tool department, which was right near the toy department. So Vernon stayed in the toy department while he went to shop for tools. And while he was in the toy department, he ended up playing a video game with Adam, who's an Atari baseball game. And Vernon says there was this disheveled man standing 15 feet away, and he was hissing at him, like, psst, hey, come here, like that.
Really?
Vernon kept trying to ignore him, but the guy kept trying to, you know, call him over. Looking at the guy, he heard a loud crack. He turns back around. It was Adam just managed to get a grand slam home run. And Adam had this big grin on his face because Adam was six and he beat the older boy. Aww. And Vernon said he was upset that he lost, so he went around to the other side and started playing Donkey Kong.
Mm-hmm.
A while later, as a 9-year-old kid, he didn't make the connection back then, but he saw this guy, the same guy that was hissing at him, with the boy passing his aisle, and he was dragging him by the hand towards the exit. And he didn't think all that much of it, but later on that night when they were at home,
mm-hmm.
The story about Adam was on the news. And so his grandmother said, hey, Vernon, he was in the bedroom at this time, said, Vernon, get in here. You know, you were at the mall in the toy department. Did you see this boy? And Vernon looks on the TV and goes, Grandpa, that's the boy I was playing the video game with. So his grandfather takes Vernon the next morning and goes to the Hollywood Police Department. As they approached the entrance, there was this big, heavyset white police officer standing there chewing tobacco. He walked up to the police officer and said, sir, I'm here to report an incident about that abduction yesterday. And the police officer turned to his grandfather and said, boy, I ain't got time for you, and spat a wad of tobacco on his grandfather's shoe. Vernon says to this day still remembers the tobacco splattering all over his grandfather's shoe, and he couldn't understand why this police officer was calling his grandfather boy when he was so much younger mm-hmm. than his grandfather. And because at that age, he didn't understand racism till years later.
Yeah.
As Vernon grew up, he wrote a very compassionate letter to John Walsh explaining that, you know, he was in the toy department. And, you know, John Walsh sent that letter to the Hollywood Police Department to call Vernon. To this day, they've never called Vernon. They refuse to call him. So, mm-hmm. and Vernon says that, you know, since that incident, his grandmother and grandfather and parents, they got him into karate school. So he grew up, he ended up getting a black belt. He opened up his own karate school, and he goes around to police departments all over the country and talks about his incident that he had. And he says, mm-hmm. and for all of that, all of these other police departments that have listened to him, the Hollywood Police Department refuses to even listen to what he's got to say. So, yeah. I mean, there's so many witnesses that point the finger to Jeffrey Dahmer and have a story to tell. They don't want to hear the stories of these witnesses.
It warms my heart to know that there are people in the world like you, Willis, that will put in the time and effort for justice, to let the voices of those witnesses that the police just decided to turn away finally be heard, and to publicly state that what they saw is fact, not fiction.
One of the reasons I do what I do another witness, Bill Bowen, out in the parking lot, who says he saw Adam being tossed into the blue van like a sack of potatoes. That's his quote. Okay. And he for a second, put his guard down because he was thinking that was an older brother. Okay. Yeah. But then the van took off so fast, he says to this day, he could still smell the burning rubber. And he got a partial tag number, gave it to the police. They, of course, dismissed him as well. Another witness, because like I said, there's so many witnesses. Another witness, Mia Taylor, who was in that same Sears toy department the day before Adam, when Jeffrey Dahmer tried to abduct her brother. And she was there also on the day, 2 days in a row, when Adam was abducted. And she saw Jeffrey Dahmer leaning over Adam, and she wanted to stay a little longer in the toy department. Her mother came, and her mother says, no, his father's here now, let's go. So they left. Mm-hmm. And so she thought, her mother thought it was his father. One witness thought it was an older brother. Another witness thought it was a stepfather. Had I gone further into that toy department, I would have known better because of the encounter I had. I would have known he wasn't his father, his stepbrother or stepfather or an older brother. I would have known better. Maybe I could have done something. That's why the fact that I know it wasn't on his tool, the fact that I know it was Jeffrey Dahmer, that he was there, not only I say that, but all these other witnesses as well say the same thing. And the police still go and pin it on an innocent man just to placate the Walshes.
Now, after doing all this research on seeking justice for Adam, what is something that people could take away from this interview to help them get a better understanding of how the justice system works and what rights you have as an eyewitness and to make sure that your voice is heard?
Well, you're asking some really good questions, and they're really tough to answer. You know, my goal is just to let people know the truth of what happened. Okay, that it was not Otis tool. He had nothing to do with this. Quit pinning murders on innocent people. I list other cases where they've done the same thing right here in South Florida, pin murders on innocent people. You know, I list some of them in my case, like think of one, Frank Smith. Okay, they pinned a murder on him that he didn't do. He spent 14 years on death row where he died of pancreatic cancer. And only after he died did they catch the real guy with DNA. In the meantime, while he was sitting on death row all those years, this real guy was committing other murders out there, 11 of them, while he was on death row. So, this, you know, they go around, they pin murders on innocent people, even though there's exculpatory evidence proving they're innocent, they'll go and hide that evidence just so to get somebody convicted. And so you have prosecutors that go along with this. You know, they say they're not prosecutors, they're persecutors. When they have evidence proving it wasn't somebody, you still go after them?
Well, and thank goodness for people like you, Willis, because that's where frustrated witness the true story of the Adam Walsh case and the police misconduct. So where can people go if they want to find some more information about you and your book and how they can order it?
Yes, you can just go to frustratedwitness.com. That's my website, okay? And I have a Facebook page. You can go to Frustrated Witness on Facebook or my personal website page, just my name, Willis Morgan. And you can contact me through there.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Willis.
I would just like to take a moment and give recognition and acknowledgement to all the good that came out of such a tragic event. It led to the creation of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, the 2006 Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act. And it also led to a new type of television show where John Walsh was putting bad guys behind bars and getting them off the streets while Reveille was helping families reunite with their missing loved ones and helping the families find justice for the ones that didn't have that reunion. It has led to a nationwide awareness where we can never let that train lose steam. I am humbled for people like Willis Morgan who have dedicated 40 years of his life to seek the truth because it's the right thing to do. So I urge you to visit his website, frustratedwitness.com, purchase his book so you get a good understanding what it's like to deal with a corrupted police department. And knowing that this little boy was the victim, John and Reveille had no voice. So they have dedicated their lives, and people like Willis to do the right thing. And I also urge you to visit the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children at missingkids.org. And it is a wonderful organization to make donations to help give this organization the tools that they need to keep up with an ever-changing world and keep these children protected. Thank you for listening to Mysteries, Mayhem, and Merlot. I am your host, Winnie Schrader, and until our next case, my fellow armchair detectives, stay safe, stay vigilant, and stay aware.